Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasagay. Pikangikum First Nation in northwestern Ontario has issued a cry for help. The community has experienced a spike in suicides over the past month and a half. A national class action lawsuit has been filed against the government over the Adopt Indian Métis program, which is otherwise known as the 60s Scoop. Missinabe Cree First Nation has recently celebrated a land transfer from the province, and the late Jack Layton is remembered by the president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs. And getting fit is a process and a journey, and it's the focal point of a TV series debuting soon on APTN. It's called Working It Out Together. Hear these stories, plus great tunes, all coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. Former chief of Pikangikum First Nation has issued a public cry for help after the community has experienced a spike in youth suicides. Five youth between the ages of 15 and 26 have committed suicide over the past month and a half in the community in northwestern Ontario. Gordon Peters says he doesn't know the reason for the suicides.
It's a question I've been asked by many as to why, and I cannot pinpoint a definite answer to that. I struggled with it for a long, long time, and still I can't come up with a reason as to why anybody would take his life so lightly.
Peters says a chief's coroner's report has been recently released to the community leadership. The report was a review of the youth suicides that occurred during 2006 to 2008. That's when 16 youth between the ages of 10 and 19 took their lives. Recommendations from the report includes recommendations to complete capital projects in the community, like water and sewer infrastructure, a new school for grades kindergarten to 12, and more housing. Peters hopes his letter to the public will get people in authority to move and wake up and take notice of the situation in Pikangikum. He adds the community is going through a lot of sadness and people are comforting each other. A national class action lawsuit has been launched on behalf of some of the First Nations and Métis people adopted during the 60s Scoop. Regina lawyer Tony Merchant is the lawyer in charge of the class action suit. He says the adoption program harmed the adoptees.
They had been taken in the 60s and 70s, Aboriginal children, First Nations children, Métis children taken, forced into adoptions frequently in the United States. And as these people became adults, they lost their culture. They had in many instances been physically and sexually abused.
Merchant adds people began to approach the law firm about 3.5 years ago to sue government over adoptions during the 60s Scoop. The lawsuit has been launched in three regions in the country with plans to expand across the country. Merchant adds the damage that people ought to get depends upon the wrong that was visited upon them, but the people who were physically or sexually abused are likely to get more money than others. Merchant expects a grade would be put together in terms of the damages that will be awarded. The First Nations Education Council won't be participating in the National Panel on First Nation Elementary and Secondary Education Discussions. The organization issued a statement August 30th. Lise Bashton, Director General of FNEC, says there are many reports out there on education and it's time to invest in education. The Director General points out several of the reports that have been done over the years, reports like the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples in 1996, and the final report of the Minister's National Working Group on Education in 2002. The organization has teamed up with other organizations that have pulled out of the discussions, including the Saskatchewan Federation of Indian Nations and the Anishinaabe Nation. The groups would like to present a parallel report with the national panel. The Missinabe Cree First Nation in Ontario recently celebrated a land transfer to the community. About 15 square miles was transferred from the province. However, Patrick Madabi, Grand Council Chief of the Anishinaabe Nation, is not happy about the transfer. He says while they don't oppose the First Nation receiving land, they do think it's a violation of Indigenous rights on several levels.
The province is allocating 15 square miles of land within Mr. Cotton's First Nation territory and also part of the Northern Superior Treaty territory. Like I don't think Mitch McCotton or the Lake Superior Treaty First Nations or the Anishinaabe Nation oppose Missinabe Cree getting a land allocation, but it would make more logical to give them land in Cree territory. After all, the Shawnee Nation occupies about 2/3 of the province. They're violating the Northern Superior Treaty and the rights of Mitch McCotton First Nation by, transferring land, in somebody else's treaty territory. It violates, constitutional protection of treaties. It violates the UN Declaration, and there's a real lack of consultation and accommodation, with Mitch McCotton and the Northern Superior Chiefs on this land transfer.
Meanwhile, Chief Rainville says the issue isn't up for public debate, but shared his personal opinion.
That Mr. Madhavi has raised is one that the union takes up with the province of Ontario, and I'm really not prepared to get into a public debate about that through the media. We have attempted to contact the union just to present them with our position in regards to the land transfer itself. But I will share with you that my feelings and my beliefs are that the treaties themselves define our relationships with government, whether it's the provincial or federal government. They don't define our relationships, or don't define the relationships between First Nations, and those are things that need to be discussed and worked out between the First Nations.
The Anishinaabeg Nation also says it had several meetings with the Ministry of Aboriginal Affairs and wanted their concerns looked into. In an email, the Ministry of Aboriginal Affairs says the province is prepared to support efforts to resolve issues between the community and wants to offer support for dialogue at the community level. Missinaabe Cree First Nation celebrated its land transfer agreement August 17th during the community's annual gathering near Sault Ste. Marie. An investigation is underway after a man died in a holding cell in a Manitoba First Nation. APTN reports the incident happened in Garden Hill First Nation, located about 600 kilometers northeast of Winnipeg. The holding cell is owned and operated by the community, and it's reported RCMP routinely use it to hold intoxicated people. The man has been identified as 44-year-old Brian McPherson, who had high blood pressure and died of a heart attack. Nadle Wutin, a member of the Yinke Dene Alliance, continues its opposition to the proposed Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline project. Chief Larry Newski says although Enbridge has announced the company has commercial support for the project, it's not going to go ahead, period. He says First Nations have already said no and will continue to say no. Newski adds the oil company will never have permission from First Nations because lands and rivers are not for sale. He says there are 100 First Nations that are against the pipeline, which is proposed to go from just north of Edmonton to Kitimat. The Missing Women Commission has announced host communities for its public forums. The commission is looking into events around the serial killer Robert Picton's case. The commission will hold forums in Prince Rupert, Tewin Terrace, Gatineau, Morristown, Smithers, and Hazleton. The forums, held throughout September, are open to the public and media, and the forums are for people to give input on the commission's mandate. The commission's hearings will begin in Vancouver, October 11th. Tribal Wiche Waywin Capital Corporation will soon find out how the federal government decided to create a $15.5 million Aboriginal loan guarantee program. The loan guarantee program had been slated for select non-Aboriginal banks and credit unions. APTN reports Winnipeg-based Tribal Wiche Waywin Capital Corporation has taken the government to court to find out why Aboriginal financial institutions weren't part of that program. The court has ordered the Privy Council Office to release internal emails between First Nation bureaucrats or explain why the documents have been kept under wraps. Currently, there are 57 Aboriginal financial institutions, or AFIs, across the country. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada is gearing up for its Atlantic National event in late October in Halifax. The TRC has scheduled 6 Atlantic hearings prior to the national event. Hearings start September 8th in Fredericton, and later in the month, Newfoundland will host 2 hearings over 3 days before the hearings move to Prince Edward Island and Nova Scotia. The hearings provide residential school survivors with a chance to share with the commission and the country their experiences. A new weight loss reality show will be hitting the Aboriginal People Television's airwaves. The program is Working It Out Together and is the brainchild of Olympian Wanique Horn Miller. The documentary-style series focuses on the health journey of 6 Mohawk people. Horn Miller says the participants in the program worked very hard.
It was a hard and painful experience sometimes for them. Very emotional because the issues behind weight and body image and, all these self-confidence issues really are deep and run deep through people, and it was hard. And that was the hardest part of my job, is to see them go through this, and only to be there and to say, hey, you can do it, and, we're here, but it really is very personal and very much their own journey.
Working It Out Together airs on APTN starting September 6th. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Hey, 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 hey,
Wildflower from the Women of Wabano. There's been 5 youth suicides over the past month and a half in Pikangikum First Nation, a remote northwestern Ontario community. The former chief, Gordon Peters, has issued a public cry for help for the community.
Well, between July 15th of this year to August 28th of this year, we lost a total of 5 youth to suicide, and ages are 15 to 26.
So that's significantly high, and do you know why that is?
It's a question I've been asked by many as to why, and I cannot pinpoint a definite answer to that. At this time, I struggled with it for a long, long time, and still I can't come up with a reason as to why anybody would take life so lightly.
But I also understand that your community has been through a whole slew of other issues, and that the chief coroner wrote a report from suicides that happened during 2006 to 2008. And can you talk about that?
Yes, he did. I think that's been in the works for a couple months now, and finally the copy that the report finally came out just a few months ago, and. As to when it will be officially released, I don't know. I don't think it's been officially released. I think it's the chief and council of our reservation have received the copy for their review, and information. And this 2006-2008 was a terrible year for Pekansgan, whereby we lost a lot of our youth again to suicide.
So what were some of those recommendations from that report?
I have, to be honest, I haven't really read the report. All I read was some of the recommendations were aimed at the government of Canada to proceed with the construction of major capital projects such as water and sewage, grid line, new school, and housing.
So that means your community is lacking in those areas?
Yes, 100%. We have there's not one house in the community that has a pipe, water, or sewage system connected. All the 400 homes in the community, not one.
So with these recent suicides, Gord, what is the community planning on doing? Are you bringing people in for counseling, or what's going on?
The reason behind my writing this letter was to try and get those people in authority to move and wake up and take notice of the situation in Pekansgan. We don't need to be calling them and telling them there's been a suicide in Pekansgan. They know the background of Pekansgan, and we don't need to keep calling them to come in every day. I think they have a responsibility to the people of Pekansgan, to the First Nations in Canada, that they should be ready and be willing to come in at notice.
So what has the mood been like in your community over the last few months?
It's been very, very sadness, a lot of sadness, and a lot of compassion to the people that have gone through these tragedies, and certainly we're trying to get together and trying to give support to each one as best as we can with the limited resources that we have in the community.
And so, what resources do you have?
I think just by being there for them, just being there and using our traditional knowledge and our traditional helpers to help them.
All right, I think that's everything from me. And is there anything else you'd like to say or add to the conversation, Gord?
Well, I'd just like to add that our 700 plus students go to school in temporary portables that were built after the main school was burned down several years ago. And to date, even though when Prentice was Minister of Indian Affairs, he promised us an $18 million school. And to date, that was way back in 2007. And to date, we still haven't seen any movement from the federal government in implementing that. And one of the recommendations that the chief coroner recommendation was that the federal government to proceed with the building of a new school for Pekansgan. Mm. And that hasn't happened. And I don't see it. And I see a light at the end of the tunnel on that project.
That was Gordon Peters of Pekanjikum First Nation. A national class action lawsuit has been launched on behalf of some of the First Nation and Métis citizens who were adopted out during the 60s Scoop, or the Adopt Indian Métis program. And Regina lawyer Tony Merchant filed that suit.
About 3.5 years ago, people started to approach Merchant Law Group to sue on their behalf because they had been taken in the 60s and 70s, Aboriginal children, First Nations children, Métis children taken, forced into adoptions frequently in the United States. And as these people became adults, they had lost their culture. They had in many instances been physically and sexually abused, and they drifted back into the Aboriginal culture. And over time, I think a momentum gathered among these people. There are just thousands of them who were impacted in this way, and we became persuaded that through all these numbers that there was a wrong, that the government had been wrong with what was then called the Adopt Indian Métis program, and has within the Aboriginal community come to be known as 60s Scoop or Lost Boys. So we've launched these proceedings in 3 different jurisdictions, and we will be launching across Canada. This is a significant wrong to largely Métis people, but in many instances, First Nations people as well.
I know that you were saying there's been a lot of people affected by it. And are there any other more specific cases or stories that you're aware of the effects of the 60s Scoop?
One of the things that happened was in order to take away a person's culture, it became a cover for physical and sexual abuse. So if a child was saying, I didn't do my arithmetic properly, a white child, a Caucasian child in grade 5, and I got beaten by my mother and father for it, or my adopted mother and father, the school authorities would have reacted. But what was happening was they purported to say, we're changing the culture, we're going to turn a red child into a white child. So they were beating them, and one of the people with whom I spoke recently, she arrived at school and she was bleeding and bloody, and as a result of that she ended up with the authorities taking her away from the people who are looking after her. So those kinds of things, unfortunately, were all too common, and that's what's led to people within the First Nations and Aboriginal leadership seeing that this is very wrong and something has to be done about it.
And what kind of damages are you seeking?
I have to go soon, but I'm going to answer this question. The damages that people ought to get depend upon the wrong that was visited on them. Everyone who was the subject of the 60s scoop, which incidentally went beyond the 60s, ought to be registering with Merchant Logged upon our website because they lost their culture, they were impacted. But the people who were sexually abused or physically abused, they're likely to get more money than others. So we would expect that there would be a sort of a grade that's put together in terms of the damages that will be awarded.
And have you found that that was an actual government program through the 60s scoop?
The government had a national program. They advertised Adopt Indian Métis. They asked people to come forward. There was television, radio, newspaper advertisements. They asked people to come forward for the purpose specifically of adopting an Indian or Métis child. It was a concerted program designed to, they thought, help Aboriginal children to go into the white mainstream, to change them from being Aboriginal to being Caucasian, and then they'd be better prepared for the world. So they took these children from homes that had a lot of children. They took them from disadvantaged homes in most instances, but sometimes from very good homes. And it was a national program, and they worked with each of the provinces, the Departments of Social Services in each of the provinces, to put into effect this national program.
And I was going to say, it's not unlike what happened with the residential schools, and then now there's been a national apology for that, and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada has been doing its work. So would you be perhaps looking for something like that?
The 60s scoop was very much like the residential school wrongdoing. Residential schools were restricted to First Nations children by and large. The 60s scoop was the same kind of thinking, the thinking that we're going to change the culture of these people, we're going to take them and take red children and turn them into white adults, which of course was impossible. And the same sort of remedy ought to be given to those people who were subjected to sexual, physical abuse and other wrongdoing, as occurred with residential schools. And Merchant Law Group was very much involved in the residential school and continues to be very much involved. Of the 17 class actions that were judged to be significant, 14 were Merchant Law Group class actions, and about half of all the victims have been clients of our 12 offices across Canada.
That was Regina lawyer Tony Merchant. Now here's Stevie Salas with Long Way to Roll.
Soul rock, you're so ho, you're the reason that the planet's got soul. Shed your skin and learn to shine. and kick much ass. You didn't give it, but you're gonna take it back. You're so rock, you're so roll. You're the reason that the planet's got soul.
Check your skin.
Anabi Cree First Nation recently celebrated a 15-square-mile land transfer from the province. It has taken nearly 20 years to get land for the community. Chief Kim Rainville explains.
The land transfer, or the celebrations that we had on the 17th of August this year, happened during our annual gathering. The Missinabi Cree over the last 19 years have brought our people together to talk about the business of the First Nation within the traditional territories of our forefathers. The land transfer itself was signed January of this past year, and we felt that it was important to commemorate the signing of that agreement. Quite a significant milestone in the efforts that have been put forward to date in moving our claim through to conclusion. The land transfer itself, the 15 square miles that are described within the agreement, are actually only satisfy part of our claim. We contend there are additional lands owed, as much as another 65 square miles of land.
So, and what was the process for the last 19 years? And I understand that there's still a bit of a process to go through.
Well, really, the process was bringing the community together initially, and that happened in 1992. Our people had, not lived on a reserve, not received reserve lands, and as a result of government policy, church doctrine, that sort of thing, the impacts of residential schools through the 40s and 50s into the 60s, many of our people left our traditional lands, homelands, to go on to other cities across the country in North America. So many people, when brought back together initially in the early 90s, many of the families hadn't had any contact with each other and as much as 30, 35 years in some circumstances. So that in itself was quite a feat. Our first elections were held. John Fletcher was elected our first, you could call him modern-day chief. And, I think he was chief for one term. And through his term, proceeded to work towards having a treaty land entitlement claim validated by the federal government. In the mid-90s, Chief Shirley Horn was elected chief of the Missinabi Cree, and her two terms as chief was able to complete the research that was required to have our claim validated by the federal government in the mid-90s. I believe it was validated in 96. It took a number of years to bring the province on board, but the province did join the table for tripartite discussions in the late 90s, and we weren't able to reach any kind of consensus as to the amount of lands that were owed. So the table itself, the discussions broke down fairly early on. And by that time, Len Nolan was elected chief, and he pursued the process, the treaty land entitlement process with the federal government. We petitioned the government to negotiate the compensation component of our treaty land entitlement bilaterally. And at the time, as policy, the federal government would work only at a tripartite table, but with pressure and lobbying, had a change of heart and agreed to sit down and negotiate bilaterally with us. I think it was about 2003. They did notify the province that they were going to negotiate the compensation component of our treaty and land entitlement bilaterally with us, and that prompted the province of Ontario to notify us that they were going to transfer 15 square miles of land to the First Nation. So it's been quite a process up to the initiation of those discussions with the province on the transfer of lands, and basically the process itself was geared to that. It wasn't so much negotiations as it was working through the land distribution policies of Ontario and working through that process.
But the land transfer doesn't sit well with Patrick Madabi, Grand Council Chief of the Anishinaabeg Nation. While he doesn't begrudge the community its land base, he doesn't think the transfer was handled properly by the province of Ontario.
Yeah, Mitch McCartan First Nation has a situation where the province is allocating 15 square miles of land right within Mitchell-Cotton's First Nations territory and also part of the Northern Superior Treaty territory. Like, I don't think Mitch McCartan or the like Superior Treaty First Nations or the Anishinaabeg Nation oppose Mississinabe Cree getting a land allocation, but it would make more logical sense to give them land in Cree territory. After all, the Anishinaabe Nation occupies about two-thirds of the province. They're violating the Northern Superior Treaty and the rights of Mitch McCartan First Nation by, you know, transferring land, in somebody else's treaty territory. You know, it violates, constitutional protection of treaties. It violates the UN Declaration, and there's a real lack of consultation and accommodation, you know, with Mitch McCartan and the Northern Superior Chiefs on this land transfer. We've been registering opposition to this thing consistently, supporting Mitch McCartan and the Superior Chiefs, and in very recent weeks, the Chief Buckle from Mitch McCartan had been trying to meet with Minister Bentley to perhaps propose a remedy, but Minister Bentley refused to meet with him. And then the other part of it, the equation, is the federal government. We've been asking for disclosure on, you know, the status of the land transfer, because obviously the federal government has to agree to this thing, and we're not getting any answers from the federal government. And here there's an announcement come out on Monday, that this transfer is taking place. And it's most unfortunate that, you know, these First Nations are getting caught up in this situation where, having to pick one First Nation against another or treaty areas against each other, you know, because of wrongdoing by the province, on trying to allocate land.
That was Patrick Madabi, Grand Council Chief of the Anishinaabeg Nation. And Chief Rainville doesn't care to have a public debate, but does share his personal feelings.
Well, the issue that Mr. Madabi has raised is one that the union takes up with the province of Ontario, and I'm really not prepared to get into a public debate about that through the media. We have attempted to contact the union just to present them with our position in regards to the land transfer itself. But I will share with you that my feelings and my beliefs are that the treaties themselves define our relationships with government, whether it's the provincial or federal government. They don't define our relationships, or don't define the relationships between First Nations, and those are things that need to be discussed and worked out between the First Nations.
That was Kim Rainville, Chief of the Mississinaabe Cree First Nation. Anishinaabeg Nation Grand Council Chief Patrick Madabi says the organization will continue to press both levels of government over the issues of treaty violation. Meanwhile, the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs declined an interview but responded via email. The ministry stated the province is prepared to support efforts to resolve issues between the community and wants to offer support for dialogue at the community level. Millions remembered the late NDP leader Jack Layton last weekend. A state funeral was held for him August 27th. Since his death, First Nation leaders were sending out condolences, and one organization held a ceremony for Jack Layton. Many remember his tireless efforts to push First Nations issues forward, and Stuart Phillip, president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, remembers Jack.
Well, like most Canadians, I truly believe that the Aboriginal peoples of this country were both shocked and profoundly saddened at hearing the news of the passing of Jack Layton yesterday. Needless to say, that Jack Layton was very much a champion for the issues of Aboriginal people across this country, and in many ways was our voice within the government of Canada. Jack was the instrumental in ensuring our national leaders, including former National Chief Phil Fontaine, Beverly Jacobs, and others were on the floor of the House of Commons during the Government of Canada's apology to the residential school system. Jack Layton also was very much pushing for Canada to to formally endorse the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and he marched and attended innumerable candlelight vigils with respect to the issue of missing and murdered women. So Jack was always walking with the indigenous peoples of this country and supporting our issues and speaking out for a full measure of justice and equity and to right the wrongs of history as it relates to the Aboriginal people of this country.
And do you have any special memories that of Jack that you would like to share?
Well, I think like most indigenous leaders, Jack was incredibly consistent. He was a powerful presence in our work and in our efforts to create a better standard of living for our people across this country. And we'll always remember his inextinguishable smile and his great sense of hope and optimism and his endless energy as he worked for the issues of social justice. I recall on one occasion where 4,000 of us were marching through the streets of Kenora, Ontario, and in the front ranks was then National Chief Matthew Kuncum and Jack Layton. He always found time to come out and walk with his brothers and sisters in the movement for social justice, and he will be greatly missed by the Aboriginal people of this country. He was most definitely our friend, our supporter, and our unrelenting, uncompromising voice in Ottawa.
That was Stuart Phillip, president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, remembering Jack Layton. Now here's Digging Roots with Brave Enough.
My hope is strong, my will is weak, and I hope that I am brave enough. I will stand tall above my feet. Brave enough.
weight, getting fit is not an easy thing. But that's the point of a new program to air on the Aboriginal People's Television Network. The series is called Working It Out Together, and it's a six-part series that follows the journeys of six Mohawk people as they strive to get healthy. And the creator of the program is Olympian Wunnie Corn-Miller.
It's a TV show that we shot last year in my community, and it was following six people along sort of their journey towards getting healthier and more fit. And what we did was we brought a whole bunch of different experts into their lives to teach them tools and different things, such as like a personal trainer, a nutritionist, a chef, even like a motivational coach. And they all got workshops and got one-on-one sessions with these people, and it was just following their lives as they went through this process.
I know that losing weight or getting fit is something that's a real personal journey, and it could make people feel very vulnerable at times. So how easy or difficult was it to get folks to participate?
Well, there were a lot of people that wanted to participate. We had a lot of people coming to the auditions because there's this kind of, you know, mainstream TV shows like The Biggest Loser that really kind of give a highlight reel of weight loss, which is, you know, not realistic in the real world. You know, like they take them, they sequester them into a house, they, you know, they have nutrition, like they can't have, their lives are taken over by trainers and nutritionists. And yeah, that's an ideal environment, but not everybody can live in that environment. And life and the issues behind why people may overeat or, you know, not have the healthiest lifestyle are there and present, and they have to deal with that. So it wasn't getting people to come to the table. It was hard for a lot of people to find the motivation and what was really interesting is understanding that. And you know, I, as an Olympic athlete, I always had a goal. I had a goal of whether it's a competition or something that I was always working towards. So you know, but to be just healthy for your own health and wellness is a hard thing for a lot of people. And I think what the most interesting part of this process was to understand that personally from my point of view, to understand the underlying things around weight and weight loss and, you know, trying to get people to understand or to value themselves enough to take care of their health. And that's that was a really humbling experience for me, as well as an inspiring experience to see all the people who participated going through this process of kind of uncovering those issues and actually facing them and doing something about them.
Mm-hmm. Well, kudos to the participants. It must have been a lot of hard work for them.
It was very hard. It was a really, I guess, it was hard and painful experience sometimes for them. Very emotional because the issues behind weight and body image and, so, you know, all these self-confidence issues really are deep and run deep through people, and it was hard. And that was the hardest part of my job, is to see them go through this, and, I mean, you know, only to be there and to say, hey, you can do it, and, you know, we're here. And but it really is very personal mm-hmm. and very much their own journey.
And so what made you decide to take up this project?
Well, I have always been very passionate about the health and wellness of my people and all people, but especially the Native world, because that's where I've gotten a chance to work and I've traveled all through North America talking about issues from right across the board, you know, suicide prevention, diabetes, all this stuff. And you know, I really wanted to, I guess, help as well as, you know, understand deeper as to what is really hindering our people from being the best versions of themselves, the healthiest versions of themselves. And it's it was a learning process for me as well.
So did you find out that answer?
You know what? What I found out was it's support. Having a cohort of people was really good. Having a group of people working together was really good. Having a cohort of people going through the same hard processes was really an interesting experience. And it was very personal for each person. And you can't minimize anybody's trauma or anybody's issues because they're so important to that battle, and having them have the strength and the self-confidence to battle those and to, you know, take control of the weight issue was the hardest part. And I think that's something that I'm really interested in, that field of motivation and having an understanding. And it really is an understanding, like, of the historical impacts and all the impacts on the indigenous world over the years, and how that's impacted us socially and, in effect, in our health, you know, and how we take care of ourselves. The self-confidence and the motivation of our people, all of that has impacted us, and it's wreaked havoc on our health, basically.
Okay, and my last question is, so what are you hoping to achieve through this series and the interactive website?
You know what? I'm hoping to bring to light, you know, some of the issues behind weight gain and the weight issues. And I'm also trying to, you know, I hope, and I know, it's not a hope, I know people out there are going to be inspired by our participants, because they're an amazing group of people. And to be inspired to go, I hope when they watch, they'll be inspired to go on their own journey to become healthier and more well.
That was Winnie Korn Miller discussing the new series, Working It Out Together, and that will debut on APTN on September 6th. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's BAMOSEDA. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.